for creating a hostile environment against Jews. You're with Jewish Voice for Peace. I want to turn right now to a clip. This is Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson facing heckling and boos when he came to Columbia University a few days ago, calling for President Biden to call in the National Guard to bring order to the campus where the students set up the encampment last week. He also called for Columbia President Manoush Shafiq to step down. Columbia students criticized Johnson's visit.
I am here today joining my colleagues and calling on President Shafiq to resign if she cannot immediately bring order to this chaos. As Speaker of the House, I am committing today that the Congress will not be silent as Jewish students are expected to run for their lives and stay home from their classes hiding in fear.
If you can talk about that as a member of Jewish Voice for Peace, Cameron.
Yes. So I think as a Jewish student on campus who represents a group of dozens of Jewish individuals, I would like to note that Jewish students have been part of the protest movement on campus since October. And there have been dozens of Jewish students who have been arrested for pro-Palestine demonstrations. So I think it's really important to recognize that there is a large anti-Zionist Jewish voice on campus. And it's also important to recognize the difference between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. Anti-Zionism is a political ideology, while anti-Semitism is in regards to Judaism, which is a culture and a religion. And it's important to know the distinction between the two. And I think oftentimes in the mainstream media and on campus, there is a conflation of the two. And it's really important to recognize that there has been an intense amount of hostility towards pro-Palestine protesters on campus. We have faced harassment. We have faced physical and verbal intimidation. I myself have been doxxed and have faced death threats online. I have been harassed on campus by multiple individuals.
And explain what you mean by doxxed.
Yeah, so I've had my personal information published online, including pictures, social media, my LinkedIn profile, etc., in which people can message me death threats and email me horrible information. And the university has done nothing to protect pro-Palestine voices and has been really cracking down on anyone who is standing up for Palestinian rights. And this really just shows how Columbia University is using similar tactics that the apartheid state of Israel is using to crack down on Palestinians in occupied Palestine.
Well, we're going to leave it there, but I do want to ask Jillian Goodman, the president of Columbia, the president of Barnard, has already had an overwhelming no confidence vote by the faculty. President of Columbia says she's asked the police to maintain a presence on campus through May 17th, 2 days after graduation. What are you expecting? As we saw yesterday, the campus almost completely shut down. Professors had their IDs canceled. Students couldn't, unless they lived right there on the campus, get in.
Yes, I think those actions shattered a sense that there is free and open access to our own resources and our own campus. The ways that they were really effectively able to bar anyone from that, I think there's really profound disappointment and anger coming from Shafiq's decision to retain a police presence on campus, as that has consistently been an ask, I think, from all sides, is to remove the police presence. And that is often what creates a threat and intimidation of violence, much more so than the protests on campus. I watched the police at around 2 a.m. load the encampment into a trash compacting dumpster, and I watched the community guidelines get crushed. And I think that, to me, was the perfect moment of seeing what that effect can be of having that police presence on campus.
Jillian Goodman, a Columbia Journalism School student covering Columbia's ongoing student protests since the first days of the encampments, and Cameron Jones, Columbia College student with Jewish Voice for Peace. We thank you so much for being with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, and it's Juan we're going to turn to next. The massive police raid on Columbia University last night came 56 years to the day after a similar raid by police, quashing an occupation, or attempting to, of Hamilton Hall by students protesting racism and the Vietnam War. A week into the historic 1968 student strike on April 30th, New York City police stormed the campus. Hundreds of students were injured, 700 arrested. The campus newspaper, the Columbia Spectator's headline read in part, "Violent solution follows here at negotiations." Juan, you were there. Juan Gonzalez, you were a leader of the Columbia Revolt. You were one of the founders of the New York chapter of Young Lords. Yesterday, we played archival clips of you and the other students taking over Hamilton Hall. What were your thoughts as you watched what happened with a student takeover and then the police raid?
Well, Amy, I think the similarities are really amazing in terms of the persistence of these students, the issues around which they were fighting, this opposition to a genocidal war occurring in Gaza. And, you know, I was struck especially by the stands of these university presidents, not only at Columbia and Barnard, but also across the country. The great Chris Hedges, I think, said it best when he talked recently about the moral bankruptcy of these presidents of these universities who are condemning disruptions of the business as usual at the universities, while every single president of an American university has been silent about the massive destruction of universities in Gaza and of high schools and schools in Gaza by the Israeli army. They are silent about what is occurring in education in another country, another part of the world, financed by the United States. So I think that the importance to me in terms of the similarities are the students understand that at times you must disrupt business as usual to focus the attention of the public on a glaring injustice. And I think that's exactly what they've been able to do. The entire country today knows what divestment means, what divestment means from the Israeli government and the Israeli military, whereas before this issue was on the margins of a political debate. No commencement in America will occur in the next month where the war in Gaza is not a burning issue, either outside with the protesters or inside in the speeches and presentations. So I think that the students have managed to focus the entire attention of the country on an unjust war. I don't see how President Shafik survives. Many of these presidents across the country are going to be known, not for whatever they accomplished previously, but they are going to be known throughout the rest of their lives as being the people who brought the police in to crush students who were maintaining a moral position of opposition to genocide. So I think the students are going to carry, those who are arrested are going to carry this badge of courage as opposed to this profile of cowardice of the university presidents that dare to try to suspend or expel them. And their lives, the students' lives have been changed forever, and I think for the best in terms of the importance of dissent and opposition to injustice.
Juan, I wanted to go back to 1968, the student strike, students occupying five buildings, including the president's office and Lowe Library, barricading themselves inside for days, students protesting Columbia's ties to military research and plans to build a university gymnasium in a public park in Harlem. They called it Gym, G-Y-M, Crow. I want to go to a clip of you from the Pacifica Radio Archives, then a Columbia student speaking right. It was before the raid during the strike.
Now we want to go into the dorms with all of you, with some of you who may not agree with a lot of what we've been saying here, who have questions, who support us, who want to know more. Let's go to the dorms. Let's talk quietly in small groups. We'll be there, and everyone in Livingston Lobby, Inferno Lobby, and Carmen Lobby. We'll be there, and we'll talk about the issues involved, and we'll talk about where this country is going, and where this university is going, and what it's doing in this society, and what we would like it to do, and how we would like to exchange with you our ideas over it. Come join us now.
So that is Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez, when he was a student at Columbia University in 1968. It was before the police raid. Juan, tell us what happened after the police raid of Hamilton Hall, as they did last night of Hamilton Hall. 700 arrests. In fact, Juan, you only recently graduated from Columbia. This is the 56th anniversary. What was it, 50 years later, a dean at Columbia said, please, we need you as a graduate.
No, actually, it was 30 years later they gave me my degree, because I was a senior then. I was supposed to graduate that year. Being suspended from college is not a big deal. You know, it only delays your career a little bit, and I think you gain more sometimes if you were suspended for the right reason. So I don't think that that's a big issue. But I want to raise something else about these protests, and I think I've seen little attention to. Back in the 60s, most of the student protests were led either by black students who were in black student organizations or white students. I was one of the few Latinos at Columbia at the time. Today, these student protests are multiracial and largely led by Palestinian and Muslim and Arab students. This is a marked change in the actual composition of the American university that we're seeing in terms of the leadership of these movements. And I think the willingness of these administrations to crack down so fiercely against this protest is, to some degree, they find it easier to crack down on black and brown and multiracial students than they did back then, what was largely a white student population. And they always figured out a way to rescind the suspensions, get the students the degrees, because they saw them as part of them. Now I think they're seeing these student protests as part of the other, and they are much more willing to crack down than they had been in the past. And I think it's important to raise that and to understand what is going on in terms of the changing demographics of the American college student population.
Well, Juan, thanks so much for being with us today and co-hosting. Juan Gonzalez, student leader of 1968 Columbia Revolt, one of the leading journalists today in the United States. Coming up, it's May Day. We go to the University of Southern California. What is the labor union and worker movement, how it links to Gaza solidarity? Back in 20 seconds. Was burning by Amel. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Today is May Day. As we continue our coverage of Palestine solidarity protests on campuses nationwide, we go to USC, University of Southern California, where graduate student workers and some 3,000 research assistants, teaching assistants, and assistant lecturers recently won their first ever union contract. This week, the union filed an unfair labor practice charge to end campus militarization and to drop charges against students and faculty taking part in the protests. We're joined in Los Angeles by Margaret Davis, president of the UAW Local 872, sociology PhD candidate, teaching assistant at USC. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk about the unfair labor practice charge with the National Labor Relations Board that your union has filed against the university and the six violations you allege must be resolved, as well as your union victory?
Yeah, absolutely. So we filed an unfair labor practice with the university within the last week because of, rampant violence that they inflicted on our workers while they were engaging in peaceful protests. And we think that's a violation of the National Labor Relations Act because it unilaterally changes workplace policies by bringing in, the Los Angeles Police Department to summon workers from their workplace. They also instituted a number of, you know, new workplace practices in requiring that people show IDs to enter campus and closing entrances to campuses that are closest to our metro stations on campus. And we also think that it was a clear act of retaliation because people were engaging in pro-Palestinian free speech, which they have a right to. So we think that these are clear violations of the National Labor Relations Act. And, you know, this is just one way that we can enforce our protections that we won in our, first ever union contract for research assistants, teaching assistants, and assistant lecturers at the University of Southern California. That was a huge victory for us and for the labor movement in Southern California overall. You know, we really began that process a few years ago when I entered my PhD. It was in 2020, and so it was a time when people were really coming to realize how precarious our condition was as workers in this really crazy world historical moment. And so there were a lot of conversations on campus about, you know, the low wages that we experience, how difficult in particular it is for parents at our university to exist as workers, and how, you know, harassment and discrimination was most targeted towards international student workers on our campus. And so we really began to organize and partnered with UAW. We had hundreds of one-to-one conversations with coworkers on campus to really collectivize and form a strong organizing committee that was representative across campus. And as of last semester, won our first union contract that guarantees for the first time in USC's history, you know, annual wage increases every year, that guarantees stronger protections against harassment and discrimination, institutes child care and dependent health care funds for parents. And so we see the enforcement of those rights and those improved benefits as certainly connected to the fight that's on the ground now to, you know, free Palestine and the genocide in Gaza.
And Margaret, you were on campus last week when over 93 USC students and community members, including five members of your union, were arrested. Can you talk about what you witnessed and how students in class are dealing with the encampment?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was there on Wednesday, and you know, the encampment is organized by a really talented group of coalition partners, really showing their power right now. They are in negotiations with the university, and they're showing that these direct actions are working in the face of very significant challenges. On the ground Wednesday, you know, what was a very peaceful and joyous and, you know, showing a lot of resistance protests in the face of really, like, challenging and horrific things going on in Gaza was met with intense police violence. And so, you know, I witnessed not only, like, my colleagues and fellow union members being, you know, beaten and arrested by the Los Angeles Police Department, but, you know, our union also was very active in, you know, making sure that we could get our members out to that if they wanted to. And so we were actually holding a monthly membership meeting that day and moved it to be close to the encampment so that folks could participate in that if they wanted to, and they wanted to participate in our union meeting. And so, you know, the union was actively endorsing this, and we have been, you know, doing so since October, putting out statements for, you know, an end to the genocide in Gaza. And it was really wild to see what happened on campus as a result of people expressing their rights. And it was also a really telling moment for what, you know, building the collective power of our union has accomplished. We were able to, you know, institute really quick jail support measures for our own union members who were arrested. We were able to be there for them at the end of the night when they had, you know, really experienced something quite horrific. And so it was, you know, a really challenging moment, but, you know, the solidarity and direct action of the encampment is really working and putting pressure on the university
to meet with them
and come to negotiation.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. PhD candidate, president of UAW Local 872 at the University of Southern California. And the National UAW, United Auto Workers, has called for a ceasefire in Gaza. Also, the main stage graduation has been canceled at USC after USC canceled the valedictory address of the valedictorian, Asna Tabassum, and then canceled the speeches of the honorary people who are receiving degrees. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Prosecutors from the International Criminal Court have interviewed staff from Gaza's two biggest hospitals, according to Reuters, in what's being described as the first confirmation that ICC investigators are speaking to medics about possible war crimes committed by Israel in Gaza. Palestinian officials have demanded investigations after hundreds of bodies were exhumed in mass graves at Nasser and Shifa Hospital following Israeli raids on the medical centers. On Tuesday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu responded to news the ICC may be close to issuing arrest warrants for him and other Israeli officials.
The International Criminal Court in The Hague is contemplating issuing arrest warrants against senior Israeli government and military officials as war criminals. This would be an outrage of historic proportions.
This comes as the International Court of Justice has rejected a request by Nicaragua to order Germany to halt exporting arms to Israel. But the ICJ declined to throw the case out entirely. Nicaragua has accused Germany of violating the Genocide Convention by providing military and financial aid to Israel. For more, we go to Reed Brody, a war crimes prosecutor, author of To Catch a Dictator, The Pursuit and Trial of Hossein Habré. He's joining us from Barcelona, Spain. Reed, can you first talk about this possibility that Prime Minister Netanyahu and others may be charged by the International Criminal Court, and the U.S. saying that the International Criminal Court doesn't have the jurisdiction to do this?
Well, of course, this would be huge, Amy. The International Criminal Court has never issued an arrest warrant for a Western official. Indeed, since Nuremberg, no international tribunal has issued an arrest warrant for a Western official. For decades, we've had this double standard where international justice has only been effective for crimes committed by leaders of developing countries or by enemies of the U.S., like Vladimir Putin. We don't know if this is true, but this would be a huge red line. I mean, there's, you know, the Palestinians have been, and Raji Sarani has been on your show a number of times, have been fighting for 15 years to bring the ICC's attention to alleged Israeli war crimes. Back in, including illegal settlements in the West Bank. And the ICC, under three successive prosecutors, has given this slow walk to those complaints. And it was always assumed that this prosecutor, Karim Khan, a British barrister who came in with American support, was very reticent, would never actually cross that red line and indict an Israeli official. But I think the overwhelming evidence of atrocities, the disproportionate attacks, the indiscriminate attacks, the collective punishment of the people of Gaza, the international condemnation, and frankly, also the genocide case brought by South Africa at the other court in The Hague, the ICJ, that resulted in a ruling by the ICJ, essentially that Israel had a case to answer. These have all made it untenable now for the ICC not to act. Now, of course, the U.S. position, as you've said, is that the ICC does not have jurisdiction because Israel has not ratified the ICC treaty. This is the historic position that the U.S. argued 25 years ago when we were drafting the ICC statute in Rome. But the U.S. was overwhelmingly outvoted, and the ICC has jurisdiction over nationals of countries that have ratified, so-called state parties, but also it has jurisdiction over crimes committed on the territory of states that have given authorization. And so, we saw under the previous ICC prosecutor, when she opened investigations into Afghanistan that potentially implicated American war crimes, when she finally opened an investigation into Israel-Palestine, that the Trump administration sanctioned the ICC for its temerity in investigating acts by officials of non-state parties. And even when those sanctions were lifted by the Biden administration, the U.S. said, we don't believe the ICC has jurisdiction over nationals of non-state parties. But then Russia invaded Ukraine, and Russia began committing massive war crimes. And then when the ICC, and of course, Russia is also a non-state party. And when the ICC began to investigate Russia and issued an arrest warrant for Vladimir Putin, the U.S. celebrated that. So it's now for the U.S. to go back and say, well, we loved it when you did it with Putin, but we think you're crossing a red line when you do it with Israel. Of course, that's just hypocrisy.
Reid, I wanted to ask you, one of the Israeli officials who spoke to the New York Times said that the possibility of the court issuing arrest warrants has been guiding Israeli decision making in recent weeks. What's the significance of this?
Well, it shows, actually, that Israel is worried about this. Obviously, they can't undo crimes that have already been committed. But many people say, well, you know, what's the big deal? I mean, Netanyahu, in fact, the ICC in 20 years has never actually got its hands on, prosecuted, and convicted any state official anywhere. But the fact is that if the ICC issues this arrest warrant, and the furious diplomatic maneuvering that's going on suggests that it may be imminent. Of course, it represents, first of all, a profound moral rebuke for Israeli actions. It makes it impossible for people to say that Israel's actions comport with the law. It also means that Benjamin Netanyahu could never, if he's one of the people indicted, could never travel to an ICC state party for the rest of his life. He could never go to Europe. But it also, you know, it also suggests that ultimately any Israeli official involved in these kinds of activities down the line could potentially also be subject to an ICC investigation indictment. So it really, hopefully, would have not only a protective effect on the past, but a dissuasive effect on Israel's actions in the future.
Reid Brody, I wanted to ask you about what's coming up this summer. We're speaking to you in Barcelona. You know, of course, Colombia just allowed police to raid the campus. Hundreds of students have been arrested. We're moving into yet another Chicago Democratic Convention. You wrote your college thesis on choosing what happens when a presidential candidate drops out at the last minute and what that means. Can you make some parallels from 68 to today?
Well, sure. I mean, in 1968, we saw that the Democrats in Chicago nominated Hubert Humphrey, who is Lyndon Johnson's vice president and a pro-war candidate, even though he had never won any presidential primary. Even though Robert F. Kennedy, before he was assassinated, Eugene McCarthy, had garnered all the votes. And so we had this massive protest against a Democratic candidate who was pursuing a very unpopular war. And so the whole primary, the whole Democratic selection process was renovated, and so that you now have primaries that and caucuses that result in pledged delegates. The unfortunate, for the moment, result of that is that Joe Biden has now accumulated enough pledged delegates to the Democratic convention so that no matter how unpopular he is among Democrats, no matter how unpopular he is as a candidate, he has enough delegates to secure the nomination. The only way that he can really be removed as a Democratic candidate is if he were to step down, in which case all of the delegates who are pledged to vote for him on the first ballot would then be released, and you'd have other candidates who could step in.
Well, we're going to leave it there, but I want to thank you for being with us. Reid Brody is a war crimes prosecutor and author of To Catch a Dictator, The Pursuit and Trial of Hissein Habre. We're going to continue the conversation and post online at democracynow.org and also talk about the ICJ decision, the International Court of Justice. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Shruf Abdelkaddous, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warren, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Uzbek. Our website is democracynow.org. You can get our podcast there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Radio Goethe. Modern German music at its best. Every Wednesday afternoon at 2 p.m. on CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. This is Radio Goethe.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.